I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hey, this is DeRay, and welcome to Posse of the People. In this episode, it's me, Kaya, and Miles talking about the news that you don't know or some issues with regard to race, justice, and equity that were underreported in the past week. Here we go. You already know the stakes of the 2024 election. Want to help but don't know where to start? Vote Save America has you covered. In 2020, Vote Save America mobilized over 300,000 people to take action. And this year, with the stakes still so high, Vote Save America is going big, going bold, going east versus west. All you have to do is sign up and you'll be assigned a team and matched with opportunities tailored to you and the causes you care about. Vote Save America will track how many calls you've made, texts you've sent, doors you've knocked, and shifts you've filled as your team pursues the biggest prize of all, the continuation of American democracy. Head to votesaveamerica.com/2024 now and get ready to organize or else. This message has been paid for by Vote Save America. You can learn more at votesaveamerica.com, and this ad has not been authorized by any candidate or candidates committee.
Family, 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 far and wide. This is the Smooth Sounds as Miles E. Johnson, and you're listening to Pod Save the People. My name is Miles E. Johnson. You can find me on TikTok, Instagram, X, at Feral Rapture. Am I using any of those right now? No, but you can find me on them.
My name is Kaya Henderson, and you can find me on Twitter at Henderson Kaya.
And this is DeRay at DRAY on Twitter.
So I want to jump right into some news. I'm not gonna front with you all. This news scares me. Because when I hear math, trauma, it, from my toes up into my to my heart, trauma just comes. And this story about these black girls who did a math problem that was supposed to be impossible to do, but they did it. I'm going to be real with you. I watched the 60 Minutes clip. Probably 11 times, and I still didn't quite understand what they did, but I know that it was great, that it was spectacular, and that it was black girls finding a possibility in the impossible. How did y'all feel? Did y'all see the clip?
I loved this story because it was, I mean, you know, they basically redefined the Pythagorean theorem, which might sound familiar to you from your high school math classes, but for 2,000 years, there was only one way to do it. And based on a challenge that the school put up for $500, these two young ladies worked really hard and figured out something new. And it makes me so excited. I mean, you know, as a little black girl, underneath all it is, I'm sure there were a zillion people who never thought that a young black student could, or a set of young black students, have the capacity to do this. And in fact, their school has gotten a lot of racist comments and emails and blowback. But I think we all know that there is infinite possibility in our community, and these, and we prove it over and over and over again in fashion, in music, in science, in inventions, and in math, y'all, math, math, math. And what I most loved about it, there was somebody who said, oh, these girls are unicorns. And the little girl said, well, if I'm a unicorn, then my school is full of a whole bunch of beautiful Black unicorns. And that is something that I say all the time. I'm not a unicorn. I come from a herd of unicorns. You just ain't never seen nothing like us before. And so shout out to Nakia and Calcia for doing the damn thing. They're now in college. They did this in high school. They're now in college. And I'm super excited for what these young mathematicians are going to continue to do to shatter people's expectations about what young, smart Black kids can do.
So they originally did this a couple years ago when they were in high school, and they are in college now. 60 Minutes has been covering, has sort of been following it, and they did a great set of interviews with their parents, with the teacher, and I love it. And these girls are G's, and not only did they solve it in high school because of the contest, but they have continued working on more proofs in college, because they're in college now, and they think that they have found five more proofs of something that they were told was impossible. And I just love it. And when you hear their parents talk about it, their parents are like, you know, we don't know, we definitely don't know this kind of math, but they're like, they just had buckets of papers where they were like working through it, like 20, 30 sheets where they just, and they kept throwing them away and starting over and throwing them away and starting over and just, and they worked it till they got it. And I just love that. It's such a good reminder as a former math teacher that practice matters. And that, you know, I think about all the people who've never had access to a whole host of things. I think about, and Kaya, you know this from schooling. I think about all the parents who were in my high school who fought for their kids, the white parents who like demanded that their kids were in the highest math classes. And I saw all these amazing, brilliant Black kids who were tracked in the lowest classes, whose parents would have never come up to the school and demand it. Like my father would have never told a teacher to do something or told the guy, like that wasn't. He like, you listen to the teacher. But I saw for the first time in high school, parents like force schools to do right by their kids because they were like, you know, you're gonna do this. And I think about how many kids we've left behind because the system just has not done right by them. So I love this story.
One of the things that really always got me with math, and I am one of those people, I don't think math is, I don't think anything's for everybody. I really don't. And how brilliant I am in certain realms and how not so brilliant I am in other realms just confirms that for me. And math was one of those, was one of those places. But I remember one of the things that would bother me when I was in school around math was that there was such a, this is the answer, this is the, this is how you get there, this is, there's really, there was no wiggle room, at least in my experience of how math was taught to me. So what's also really almost like magical about this story is that math, which is something that is so like static and this is how you get here and there's no, and there's not too many shortcuts or other ways to think about it, like that, that math has become like liquid with this story, and that even something as static and solid and concrete as math has become like liquid in the minds of these Black girls. That was really cool to me.
Last week I participated in a webinar with a bunch of academics around shifting math mindsets, right? And the point of this is the fact that we have told people that they can't do math or not everybody is math-minded and whatnot. And the simple power of shifting these narratives for helping people understand that math is not static. Math is actually very fluid, for helping people understand that practice is, like, practice actually makes you better at math. That struggle is part of the thing. And then making math relevant, like when kids are solving problems that are worthy of their time and attention, that have impacts for themselves, their families, their communities, like kids are actually great at math. And when kids get a really good math foundation. And so one of the things that we've got to do in this country is renegotiate our relationship with math. There is a set of people who want us to continue to believe that math is only the purview of a small group of really smart, usually white, usually men, people. And the truth of the matter is, young ladies like Nakia and Calcia have every right to math as these, you know, old, stale, pale, male people. And so I'm here for it all. I'm here for helping educators understand how they can break the current math mindsets and help people embrace math in new ways.
Yeah. I bet even watching that story before you start your math classes, like watching mm-hmm. that, like having that be a part of it, I bet that mm-hmm. will even change how Black kids attack math.
Yes.
To one number to the other, 69 God, Drake, Kendrick Lamar. One thing I do know is 4 + 4.
Come on, transition.
Eight. I know Kendrick ate that. That is math that I know how to do. So I got my start. One of the first places that ever asked me to write was OK Player. My mom reminded me that there was this website called allhiphop.com that I used to lie and be able to write for when I was 15 and I was too young to really work, but I would write for that. So I say what to say is, I love hip hop culture. I would consider myself a student of hip hop. This has been one of the most exhilarating days in hip hop in an extremely long time. If you have been absolutely living next to SpongeBob SquarePants under the sea and you don't already know this story, Kendrick Lamar and Drake have been beefing. And when I tell you, Kendrick, they have not been letting each other breathe. There hasn't been a solid 24 hours since Euphoria dropped, that there hasn't been a song response from Drake. And then once Drake dropped something, I believe that it was 15 minutes after Drake dropped the Family Matters, Kendrick Lamar drops Meet the Grams, which is this like very haunting, almost scary horror rap takedown of Drake as letters to Drake's family members, starting with his son. Then when you think it's all over, Kendrick Lamar comes back and does a victory lap in the form of Not Like Us and really buckles down on some really nasty claims that Drake was messing with minors. And there's this like line in that says, a minor, and that kind of is just, I don't know. It's one of those things where I don't even know if you can come back. Like, specifically in the age of the internet, now that that is out there, now that that is a song, now that people were in the streets crip walking to it and drinking and talking about it and laughing about it, it's like that is like forever a part of your legacy now, even as gross and as sad as that is. But anywho, child, how did y'all feel about this rap beef? Again, I think that this is exciting because I do think that Drake and his ghostwriters are extremely talented. And I think that Kendrick Lamar is also really talented.
Drake
as well.
And his ghostwriters. So and like his ghostwriters. Shout like out to the ghostwriters.
You gotta shout them out. I see dead people. I think that the tension and seeing two rappers who are on top of their game go back and forth has been really exciting. And like, let's be honest, like hip hop rap music right now has not necessarily been centered around skill, has not been centered around storytelling, has not been centered around the competitive nature of I deserve to lead this cultural community into its next era, which is what the king of rap is, right? Is that person who's leading this cultural community into its next era and being able to deserve that. There hasn't been that competitive nature in it, and it's just seemed to be back, and it's been exciting, and like my favorite YouTubers have been going live every 15 minutes because of that. And let me excuse myself. So Kendrick Lamar dropped Meet the Grams 1 hour after Drake dropped Family Matters. So again, did not give him even a full 24 to be able to breathe. Where were y'all at when this dropped? How do y'all feel? Do you have favorite lines? Will you be writing the eulogy?
So I was disappointed in Drake's reply. I thought this last thing was going to be a little better than it is. But, you know, it's been interesting. People have been like, you know, we're focusing too much on this. I will tell you, this was the only thing on my timeline yesterday. It was I see nothing else but Drake and Kendrick. And what's interesting about it is that it led to a host of conversations about the grooming that happens in the entertainment industry, about misogyny noir, about friendship, about a whole host of things. Like, it was a really expansive conversation that happened. And even today, you know, people are like saying the obvious, right? That like, there's really no reason why a 35-year-old should be friends with a 15-year-old, like friends. You're like, this is a weird thing. You know, that whole conversation about Millie Bobby Brown, that's her name, right? And with Drake's text to her. And I even that, you know, I was telling, what, me and my friends were talking about it. And I'll never forget being in the same room as Sasha and Malia. And I almost went up and said something to them. And I'm like, Dre, you a grown man. There's not a world where I will go up to an 11-year-old and be like, can I get a picture? Like, that just, no matter who you are, that doesn't make sense. I'm an adult. And I remember being like, oh, that's Sasha and Malia. And I'm like, leave them alone. They're kids. Everybody leave them alone. They are children. And I think that this, you know, Kendrick ate him up. There's nothing I can say, but ate him for breakfast, lunch, dinner. I almost am like, Kendrick, don't put out another record because it's too, he already down. Just let him stay down. It's too much. But Kendrick did that. And, you know, I will also say that this is like, you know, you just don't like somebody and you don't even got to pretend. You ain't got to make something up. Kendrick is like, I don't like him. And that's it. And you're like, you know what? I get it.
Not also, a lot of people don't like
Drake, I realize.
Not I don't like him.
Oh,
I hate him. I hate you. I hate the way you say bloop. I hate the bloops you bloop. I hate the, like, this is not I don't like you. This is a whole different level, a completely different level of disregard and disrespect. Sorry, go ahead.
The only thing I'll say is, no, the last thing I forgot, sorry, Metro Boomin's contest spawned Genius because some of those raps, Metro Boomin, a famous producer, he put out a beat and asked people to rap over it, criticizing Drake. Some of the stuff people all, I heard something from Paris, like people were on it.
So this is the auntie version of the, of the thing. And full disclosure, like I heard Euphoria when it dropped and I might have listened to it 10 different times. I thought it, like, it is brilliant. And every single time you listen to it, you get some new nugget, some different understanding of a metaphor. Like, it is absolutely brilliant. And I was like, this is what happens when you let a Pulitzer Prize winner get at you, right? And like, I was like, okay, we are, to me, I was around when hip hop started, and this is the essence of hip hop, right? Beefing, diss tracks, like this is, and I was like, oh my God, we're finally past the mumble rap phase. We are back to like real hip hop. This is quintessential hip hop. And then I listened to Not Like Us. Oh, wait, can I also just say, let me pause parenthetically to say that part of the reason why Euphoria had me in a chokehold is because it starts off with a little Teddy Pendergrass, which is my favorite, my most favorite, honey. Ow, come on. See, this is what I'm talking about. Anyway, then I listened to Not Like Us. And I was like, oh my God, like, this is bananas. This is so crazy. Meet the Grams. I don't know, somewhere in auntiedom over the weekend, running around, doing errands, doing other things. I missed the whole second part of this thing. So now I got to go back and pull it all together. But I say all of that to say, energizing, exciting, like even for the olds like us, like this is hip hop, baby. This is hip hop. And I will say, I agree with you, DeRay. Rick Ross said, he was like, you know, listen, me and you got beef, Drake. I'm not your friend, but clearly you don't have no friends. So I'm going to tell you what your friend should tell you if you had some. Don't respond to this. Just leave it alone. Just go away, whatever, whatever. And apparently that's not what happened. Now, I will also say, did you hear this thing about Rick Ross's plane had to land and he said that Drake attacked him with a fighter jet? Y'all, come on. Let's just stop acting foolish around here. But where'd Drake get a fighter jet from? Tell me that. And really, Rick Ross, you think you're that important? Okay, anyway. But I love this. I love, love, love this. I'm excited to go back and listen to part two, piece them all together, and think about this some more. So, yeah.
It's so good. And then the other thing, too, is, you know me, I'm always thinking about, like, anytime things are, like, conflicting, I always think about, like, the idea of people and, like, what they represent. And I forgot if it was just you or Durag or maybe both of you all said how you didn't know so many people didn't like Drake. And I think that's true, but I also think so many people, specifically when I think about the listeners, I think so many people have been upset around the commerce side of rap being above the cultural talent side of rap. You know what I mean? And I think that Kendrick is like symbolic for a lot of stuff. I always think when things like this happen, somebody's symbolic for something. That's just how my brain works. But it is hard not to see that Kendrick Lamar isn't also symbolic for a type of rap that isn't dictated by the internet, that isn't dictated by gossip, yes, that isn't dictated by, that you can't act your way into. You know, I'm 33, so I remember Drake and Degrassi. Great guy. You know what I mean? Really innocent. So it's really weird to see somebody, this suburban kid who's a child actor, like act his way into this status and for nobody to, you know, even on Euphoria, he reverses Richard Pryor in The Wizard of The Wiz when he says, you know, everything they say about me is true. That's Richard.
The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 30th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Why choose a Sleep Number smart bed?
Can I make my site softer?
Can I make my site firmer?
Can we sleep cooler?
Sleep Number does that. Cools up to 8 times faster and lets you choose your ideal comfort on either side. Your Sleep Number setting. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store and online. And now, the more you buy, the more you save on beds, bases, and more. Plus, get free home delivery on most beds with base. Limited time. For J.D. Power 2025 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Check it out at a Sleep Number store today.
Prior saying that in reverse, so really saying that, no, this is a fake. This is somebody who's pretending to be something that he's not, and we're talking about it. So it feels like that kind of cultural battle's happening too, not just around Drake and Kendrick Lamar, but around art versus commerce. And I think that's why so many people are energized by this as well, because I think so many people are tired of just everything being so much about commerce.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned, there's more to come.
Mine is about the, you know, the government only works because there are layers and layers of people and processes that allow it to work at scale. And I'm always interested in how that happens. My first fascination of it was in school systems, and I saw, like, you know, if the woman who processes your leave is out, you probably are screwed. Or if there's a new person who does this one thing, you're in a bind. And what I'm talking about today is in New York City, that there are 28 marshals who help collect debts owed in New York City. And there are 11 of them who New York City's watchdog agency has actually filed charges against. And this is a level of corruption that completely disrupts people's lives. And I was fascinated by it. And to think that 11 out of 28 people have charges against them. And as somebody who used to work inside the government, I can only imagine what they have not uncovered. So let me explain what happened. The marshals, and I didn't even know these people existed. The marshals are the people who enforce court ordered evictions and money judgments. They do not make any money. They don't have a salary. I mean, they do actually make money, interesting, but they don't have a salary. And they're appointed by the mayor to 5-year terms, and they're allowed to keep 5% of whatever they collect. But they must turn over to the city 4.5% of the gross amount collected. Some of the marshals, even though they don't make a salary, they, because of the what they can collect, they make over $1 million annually. Now, what got them in a bind is that some of the marshals were levying liens on things outside of their jurisdiction. And those people sued. And that is seemingly what tipped this off. Legal Aid has also been complaining that they have not been giving people 2 weeks' notice before they do the evictions. And I was reading about this and I'm like, you know, I didn't even know this existed, but I will tell you that this whole setup just feels like a gateway to corruption. It makes sense to me that you would have people who can levy liens and all that stuff because, you know, somebody has to enforce it. That makes sense. But you have created a financial incentive for them to do it. And that feels like not the goal of public service. And I can only imagine that, you know, the people that sued them were like already had a lot of money. So they were getting levies on them, but they were a big business who was deemed a predatory lender, but they were like a big company. I think about all the people that these marshals have probably screwed over who don't have the means to sue, who don't have the resources to push back, whose lives have been forever changed because this small group of people with an extraordinary amount of power and no oversight have wreaked havoc. So I wanted to bring it here because I learned in this.
Well, A, thank you for bringing this in because it's always seemed like something really shady and like wildly criminal is happening underneath all types of like public service. And I think that, again, often that can be overwhelming and these stories are really important. I think the main broad thing that I always return to when I hear stories like this is how certain things, in my opinion, should not be financially incentivized. Mm-hmm. Like, I think that is like the motivational factor. I think about how many people I know who have had their lives changed because of eviction, because of these different different things. And when I look at articles like this, it shows that the financial incentives are also making it so that these type of horrible and to me just at least socially criminal behaviors persist where because you have that financial incentive to do them. And that's the big thing that always strums my heart is just that we should be doing public service because the public deserves to be served, not because it's a means to get rich or to be able to get money.
I think that's right. The incentives are all wrong. I would also say oversight is all wrong because the Department of Investigations knew that these people were not doing the right thing. The article notes that there were 550 complaints about city marshals and since 2019, and they've initiated 30 investigations. How are you? Those numbers don't even sound right to me. If you got 550 complaints against a set of 28 people, it's only 28 of them, then you know that something is rampantly wrong. And so you shirk your oversight ability or responsibility if you're only looking into 30 of them or you're not hiring an outside organization to do the deep investigation. And so, you know, I think that good for these people for suing, even if they are bad people. A broken clock is right twice a day, as my grandmother would say. And, you know, it also, I think, is important to remember that without a free press, we don't know about things like this. And I think that the press is increasingly compromised and disincentivized and punished from writing stories like this. But keep going, journalists. Keep on doing this so that we know what's happening with these are our tax dollars. These are our tax dollars that these people are keeping. And clearly, this is an area of the government that's in need of deep reform. My news this week comes to us from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, where, in fact, secession is happening. Not succession like the show, secession, which is the breaking away of a municipality from another municipality. Here is the story. Baton Rouge, Louisiana public schools, it starts with schools, which I always say are a microcosm of society. The school district is largely Black, and most of the folks in North Baton Rouge are Black and low income. The school district is becoming more and more colorful each year. In the southern part of the city, there is a small community called St. George, which is largely white and affluent. And since 2015, St. George has been trying to secede or break away from East Baton Rouge. First, they wanted to create their own school district because they feel like the people running the school district are wasting their tax dollars and failing their kids because they're not providing them with a high quality education. And they pursued a few different legal strategies to try to incorporate their own school district. They all failed. And so they took a page from what's happening in a number of cities and counties around the country where largely white affluent populations are voting to incorporate their own cities, to break away from Baton Rouge and create the incorporated city of St. George. And as I said, this started in 2015, failed a couple of times. In 2018, they re-upped and went at it in a different direction, this citywide incorporation. And last week they won at the Louisiana Supreme Court. And so St. George will be able to pull completely away from Baton Rouge. It will have its own school system. It will have its own city services. And this is a strategy that's not just happening in Louisiana. It's happening all around the country. Shelby County schools pulled away from Memphis. In Birmingham, you only need a few hundred kids to create your own school district. And so all of the wealthy white communities have pulled out of Birmingham public schools, leaving it to be almost completely Black and completely low income. And for those people who don't understand the implications beyond race, there is a financial implication, right? School districts are funded on the city's tax base. And so the estimation of St. George moving out of Baton Rouge, they believe it to be a $48 million loss of taxes to the city, but it's also a loss of funding for the school district. And so when I think about the dystopian future, this puts us on a pathway to, you know, gated communities, gated cities, walls around cities, because people don't want to be with other people's children. And the children who are most likely to suffer are poor Black children. There is a community in Atlanta that has pulled out because it didn't want its white children to be with Negro children. And that is that's the town that these St. George people are basing their example on. And so this is economic racism, this is academic racism, and this is just plain old, I don't want my children with those colorful children racism. And I think we're going to continue to see more of wealthy white communities pulling out every policy stop that they possibly can to move far away from us, to continue to create rules that kill and destroy, not just individually like we saw with the CHIPS program last week in Florida, but that destroy us collectively. And I brought this to the pod because I wanted people to...
Thank you so much, Kaya, for bringing this to the pod. I know that DeRay probably has something way more, hopefully, profound to say than I do right now. But this definitely reminds me of white flight, of course. And also, and I feel like I've maybe said this a couple of times on this pod in the last 2 weeks, but I think that sometimes we... because of what's happening in Israel and what's happening in Palestine and like what's going on, that sometimes we can always externalize the the genocides that are happening over there. This, to me, is also one of those ways that you exterminate futures. This is also one of those ways that you wield your white power in order to annihilate Black possibility by knowing that there's certain types of funding, certain types of, you just know, money, incentive, attention that you'll get when you have a mixed school, a mixed class school, as well as a mixed race school, and you are intentionally taking that white power away so these Black children won't get the crumbs of it. You know what I mean? There's so many things that happened to me. I went to school in Georgia. There's so many things that I was able to participate in simply because there's so many things that I got to participate in, not because I was just this special Black kid, but because there was some white kids who went to my school, and because we had a mixed class or mixed class, and I'm saying classes in financial income type of school. So there were certain possibilities that were available to me that I got to benefit from, that if those white kids or those white families decided to do this, they wouldn't even be tangible to me. So I do see this as a type of like legalized violence. I see this as a type of like wielding of a certain type of white supremacist violence that I think that maybe feels harsh to name it like that, but I don't really see any other way to think about it, you know, because we all know what's going to happen to lower income Black kids who don't have access to programs or the financial backing that they should have. We all know what's going to happen to those kids. So it's hard for me to imagine it any other type of way.
The only thing I'll say is, A, I didn't know that the secession efforts in Louisiana date back hundreds of years, that it seems like they are able to do it now, but they've been trying to do this for a long time. They've been trying to secede from the country. They've been trying to break apart the state, and that the history of voter suppression in Louisiana is long, that they had a reading requirement that they called the understanding clause of their state constitution that said, if you don't understand the constitution, you can't vote. As you can imagine, they deemed it that the Black people didn't understand the Constitution, so they disenfranchised hordes of people. They have a felony disenfranchisement law, so if you were convicted of a felony in the past, they make you jump through hoops with paperwork to regain the vote. They're being sued by civil rights groups for it, but they make you personally hunt down information that the Department of Corrections already gives the state just to prove that you really want to vote. And they do these bureaucratic hoops. But the last thing I'll say about Louisiana is, you probably remember that they were found in violation of the Voting Rights Act because they had gerrymandered the map so much that the people in Baton Rouge were disenfranchised at the state level with elections, namely like the state Supreme Court. They had to redo the map. They redid the map. The governor just signed the map. And then the Louisiana State Supreme Court, with two Trump people, has now said that the map is deemed unconstitutional. Now, this has already been an issue with Alabama. The court ruled that they had to fix the map. It is likely that the Supreme Court will intervene and they will also have to fix the map again. But what the Republicans are playing in Louisiana is a time game that, you know, the Supreme Court's going to go on break at some point soon. So the Supreme Court might just not weigh in until after November. And this racist map might be the map that people have to vote in.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got.
Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work. With over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you. And most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 30th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
In the next election, knowing that is disenfranchising people. And that is really the long game that they're playing. We say it every week, but they could not win if they did not cheat.
Don't go anywhere. More Pod Save the People's coming.
And not to beat a dead horse or, I don't know, beat a dead Drake, but let's kind of move back to some news that dropped while we're actually taping. So I don't know if y'all saw this exchange. So Morgan Jerkins, who was a friend of mine, brilliant writer, for the last year and a half, I believe she's been at Princeton as a professor in Princeton. She's just a brilliant woman. She had this exchange with DJ Vlad. If you don't know who DJ Vlad is, he is a white interviewer who does white interview series on hip-hop culture. So a lot of people have been interviewed by DJ Vlad. Really, if any black comedian, rapper, bodyguard with salacious gossip, like anything that's in that world, they probably have touched in some way DJ Vlad. So the original exchange goes basically DJ Vlad critiquing Kendrick Lamar's Not Like Us song and saying it could have used a better mix. Morgan Jerkins says, responds to that and says, "You are white. This is a black folk affair." Basically saying, let's not center your opinions or your ideas in this black discussion. DJ Vlad then goes to tag Princeton and basically tell Morgan that, hey, is this how you do business? Is this what a Princeton professor should say, is that white people can't comment on hip hop stuff? And essentially tries to get her fired and says that on Monday she's gonna go and get her fired. He just tweeted after just a litany of tweets over the weekend saying she was gonna get her fired. He then says, "Since it's Monday, let me clear the air and state that I never had any intention of filing a complaint to Princeton for former professor Morgan Jerkins saying that white people aren't allowed to comment on Kendrick Lamar's music. She trolled me and I trolled back. At the end of the day, it creating an interesting discussion about race relations in America. I will be discussing it further in my future interviews." Morgan Jerkins replies back, "A lie. He tagged my employer multiple times with the intention to professionally harm me. I didn't troll. I center black people in the discussion on hip-hop and told him to stand down because it's not his space. He's backtracking because he miscalculated. By the way, stop contacting my family." Also, what you might not know is that Morgan Jerkins is also related to Rodney Jerkins, so that Jerkins name is real. You know, she has real good Brandy stories.
We have gotten
meals and coffee when I first got here, and she got some good Brandy music stories that I felt that were juicy. So if you don't understand why DJ Vlad might try to actually contact her family, it's because her family is in a part of music history as well. So did you see this? And then again, I wanted to tie this back in with, it feels like this Kendrick Lamar versus Drake thing is this commerce versus art thing. And I feel like DJ Vlad maybe miscalculated a little bit, because it seems like people were so geared up by Kendrick Lamar being like, yeah, you're not one of us. And then DJ Vlad saying something and be like, yo, you're not one of us either. I feel like a lot more people felt energized to call out and or to fight back these kind of like culture vultures that have been in the culture and be like, yo, like, it's not just Drake who we're talking about right now. We're talking about everybody who is taking pieces of hip hop and using it to profit. We're tired of it all. And it feels like DJ Vlad might have miscalculated what he was able to do as far as a white man, as far as a troll, as far as an internet personality. I think he really miscalculated who he was talking to and who was viewing and how the public would respond. Because let's be real, usually you can do that to black women on the internet and nothing happened or nobody come to save her. But I think Morgan has a lot of cultural cultural privilege, Princeton Jerkins family member. But then also, I think that this era, in this moment right now, people are tired of seeing stuff like that. And that was just horrible optics. But what do y'all think?
I do think there are a lot of really interesting conversations that were spawned because of the back and forth and that, frankly, are still going on this morning. I love that Morgan didn't let him off the hook, you know, because Vlad, I did an interview on DJ Vlad about the protests a long time ago. I had no clue who he was. It was just like another, you know, I'm like, I'll talk about the protests on any venue I can and da da da. I had never heard of him before. And the more I learned, I'm like, oh, his niche is like the old rappers who aren't being interviewed anywhere else. And like, he just creates a lot of news from these sort of things. And but he definitely tried to get her fired. And his like try to rebrand this morning was like, it was the most Karen thing of all to not be like, well, let me just disagree with you, Morgan, but immediately be like, Princeton, let this woman. You're like, come on.
I didn't know who DJ Vlad was. So thank you to the auntie crew for hipping us to the culture. Well, not the culture, to the people in and around and exploiting the culture. But first of all, I read Morgan's whole entire thread, and she keeps it classy, but she not let him off the hook is the nice way of saying it. Like, she's like, first of all, do you know who I am? Like, and I didn't say you can't comment. Like, this is what I am saying. And so I thought her takedown was just lovely. But more than that, the different people who have come to her aid or who've come to defend her. There's a professor at the University of Maryland who wrote, "Hey, Vulture Vlad, I'm a professor at the University of Maryland College Park. Please also call my job to complain about me on Monday because I think your colonizer-like engagement with hip hop has earned Black folks the right to ask you to stay out of these discussions. Peace." Shout out Rian Amlicar Scott. I do think that one of the questions around hip hop is who does it belong to, right? And I think, you know, I've been all over the world. I've been in Peru and seen people, you know, rapping and popping and DJing and whatnot, and Japan and blah, blah. And I love hip hop's universalism and reach and whatnot. And I think that, this is just my personal opinion, you could agree or not agree, but Black people started hip hop. And so hip hop belongs to us. We invite you to participate, but don't get it twisted. Like, hip hop is ours. This is my problem with, you know, the people who think that Eminem is the greatest rapper of all time. Say what now? I'm not saying a white person could not be the greatest rapper of all time. I'm just saying we have not hit that cultural moment yet. And so I think this is about race in lots of places. I mean, whatchamajigget? Kendrick calls Drake a colonizer, right? You know, when you need credibility, you go to Atlanta and 21 Savage and Lil Baby and blah, blah, blah. Like, you are, like, all of this is about race. And so, of course, it would play out in, you know, in Twitter back and forth and whatnot. But this, I mean, that's what makes this Kendrick stuff so amazing. Like, there is a whole history lesson for people who were not listening or who don't know Black history. I mean, I don't know. Sorry. Okay, I'm back to the analysis. I can't get away from it. Like, there's so much here.
I think Kendrick did such a masterful job at the narrative he wanted to push that it put Drake in defense. So Drake couldn't really come back and diss Kendrick Lamar for 5 or 7 minutes. He had to clean up these accusations, which might be really good as far as, you know, Gwyneth Paltrow inviting you to dinner, or, you know, you being able to get invited to certain, you know, damage control for the bigger commercial machine that is Drake. But it doesn't do a lot when it comes to hip hop reputation that you're over here being like, I didn't do that. I didn't say that. I wouldn't do that. Did it all. You kind of have to like just not to ignore it. So Kendrick Lamar put him in a very interesting place because when you're big in commerce, you have to protect the product. And if the product is something in my post Me Too world that's saying to be predatory, you have to clean that up. So Kendrick put Drake in a really interesting position. I think the other thing too that I've seen people talking about is how, I don't know, as a student of hip hop, but also a student of disco, I see a lot of people kind of talking about how don't be distracted by this beef because of, you know, of course, what's happening in Colombia and the encampment and then and what's happening just in Palestine and genocide. I really resent when people make it seem as though people can't do two things at one time. And I also think moments of really huge tension also call for really huge relief. And I think that is what birthed hip hop, is that drug era, was those ghettos, was the crack era. And I think that's also what birthed disco, was a lot of was just the same thing. I don't know if disco would have been as necessary if, like, we weren't talking about the Vietnam War and, like, in a lot of the other in the civil rights movements that were happening. So I think that a lot of times we see in culture that moments of huge tension also need huge relief. So I think that it's possible to say free Palestine and lock up Drake at the same time. I think that we have complicated enough minds that we can say enough. So I always resent when people make it seem as though we can't chew gum and walk at the same time. I know that we can. I've seen it. And I think often moments like this also galvanize people to do the political stuff too. It gives people escape. You kind of need something to refresh your mind or to energize your spirit a little bit in order to do whatever work you're called to do when it comes to what we're facing politically. But I also think we're in a place where everybody has to say something. So I think sometimes the contrarian thing is the only thing people have available.
I think that's right. I was in a museum last week. And it was an archaeological museum in Mexico, and it was looking at pre-Columbian civilizations and all of this stuff. And one of my girlfriends said to me, it's really interesting that there are all of these wars and politics and stuff in the pre-Columbian society, but the only thing that persists is the art. What we have left is the art. And I think it is critically important in moments like these to not just be caught up in the politics and what have you, but art is an expression of our politics. Art is an expression of our culture. Art is the thing that will persist. And so the artists are our scribes, they are our messengers, they are the people who leave the history for us to tell. So it is, you know, a lie to say that the art is not important. The art is critical because the art is the thing that persists.
Well, that's it. Thanks so much for tuning in to Bossy and the People this week. Don't forget to follow us at Cricket Media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And if you enjoyed this episode of Bossy and the People, consider dropping us a review on your favorite podcast app. And we'll see you next week. Bossy and the People is a production of Cricket Media. It's produced by AJ Moultrie and mixed by Vasilis Poutopoulos. Executive produced by me, and special thanks to our weekly contributors, Kai Henderson, DR Ballinger, and Miles E. Johnson.